Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening. This is Ellie Steele. And tonight's show is a... we're going to have George Dixon join us tonight instead of tomorrow night. Tonight we're going to commemorate the life of Zachariah Sitchin's, who is the author of the Earth Chronicles and the decoder of the Sumerian tablets. He also was the founder or the discoverer of the tablets, discovered the existence of the Anunnaki, which are the ancient extraterrestrials who were credited by the Sumerian tablets for the existence of our race, actually the altered human race. Okay, and I'm going to read an introduction just a second from Zachariah Sitchin's credited from Jim Marr's text on the rule by secrecy, where he first where he mentions this. He says that all the ancient people believed in gods who had descended to earth from the heavens and who could at will soar heavenwards, explained Middle Eastern scholar Zachariah Sitchin's in the prologue to his first book of a series detailing his translations and interpretations of Sumerian accounts of their origin and history. But these tales were never given credibility, having been branded by scholars from the very beginning as myths. Okay, and recognizing that even the most learned researcher from the turn of the 20th century could not possibly have begun to think in terms of concepts we accept as commonplace today, Sitchin's reasoned, now that astronauts have landed on the moon and unmanned spacecraft explore other planets, it is no longer impossible to believe that a civilization on another planet, more advanced than ours, was capable of landing its astronauts in the planet Earth sometime in the past. It is significant to learn that the Sumerians never considered or referred to the beings who brought them knowledge as gods. This was a latter interpretation by the Romans and Greeks, who fashioned their own gods after the earlier oral traditions. And the Sumerians called them the Anunnaki, or those who came to Earth from heaven. And get involved with that. And it says, to understand the Sumerian version of the origin of humanity requires only a slight shift in mindset. And Sitchin, who has done so much to synthesize the vast amount of Sumerian knowledge into a consistent, if extraordinary, hypothesis, often has told how this his shift of mindset occurred as a schoolboy studying Hebrew in Palestine. Sitchin's had the audacity to question why the Old Testament term Nephilim, N-E-F-I-L-M, was translated as giants, when the original word meant those who were cast down. And predictably, instead of being praised for his initiative and attention to accuracy, young Sitchin's was chastised for questioning the Bible. But the incident set him on a lifetime quest for the truth behind the inconsistencies and puzzles of the ancient text. And Sitchin's question was well-founded. Rather than simply giants, the Holman Bible Dictionary defines the Old Testament Nephilim as ancient heroes who, according to most interpreters, are the products of sexual union of heavenly beings and human women, as stated in Genesis 6:4. From the New International Bible. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterwards when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them, and they were the heroes of old men of renown. And a native of Russia, Sitchin's was educated in Palestine and London, where he graduated with a degree in economic history from the University of London, following studies at the London School of Economics and Political Science. And after a stint as a writer and editor for economics and historical journals, Sitchin's relocated to New York City in 1948 and soon became a U.S. citizen. During his years of study, Sitchins became fluent in a number of languages, including ancient Egyptian, Hebrew, and Akkadian, a later form of Sumerian. And Sitchins and others have simply taken the attitude that perhaps the ancient Sumerians were putting down on their clay tablet history as they understood it rather than their myths. After all, the Sumerian descriptions of many ancient cities were believed fanciful stories until their ruins were discovered and excavated. And why not also consider their written history as reality? And after years of dedicated translation and study, Sitchins realized that the biblical Nephilim and the Sumerian Anunnaki represented the same concept, that in the Earth's most distant past, beings came down from the stars and founded the earliest civilizations, a theme which has run through nearly all secret societies, from Freemasonry to Thule Society, as previously recorded. And using Sitchin's translation as a springboard, many authors in recent years have contributed to a more detailed understanding of the Anunnaki story, and based on Sitchin's work, as well as others, including Alan F. Alford, R. A. Bouvet, Neil Freer, and Dr. Arthur David Horn, Dr. Joel Lewis, and C. L. Turnage, Loyal Pye, Lawrence Gardner, and William Bromley, the account of the Anunnaki went something like this. And George is on the line there, and I'm going to bring him up in just a second. If you just hold on for a second, George, I just want to finish this preface here. About 450,000 years ago, a group of spacefaring humanoid extraterrestrials arrived at planet Earth. They came from a planet about three times the size of Earth, which the Sumerians called Nibiru. And Nibiru was depicted in the ancient Sumerian literature as the 12th planet of our solar system. As early as 1981, American scientists were theorizing the existence of the 10th planet in our system based on sightings by an orbiting telescope and studies of irregularities in the orbit of Pluto, indicating an additional solar body. If new evidence from U.S. Naval Observatory of the 10th planet in this solar system is correct, it could prove that the Sumerians were far ahead of modern man in astronomy, and commented a writer for the Detroit News, "There is no inconsistency here, as the Sumerians counted the moon and the sun as planetary bodies, thus arriving in the number 12, at the number 12, the same number as their pantheon of Anunnaki overlords." And the book goes on, and it's a fascinating account, and he does a remarkable overview of Sitchin's work in The Rule by Secrecy by Jim Mars. And we're going to bring up George here right now. And hello, George. You with us?
How you doing, Leo? I'm here.
George.
It was a great introduction.
Yeah, I thought it was a great intro from Jim Mars on this, on Zachariah's work. And I'm glad for those of you who may not know, the reason we're commemorating his work is because Zachariah Sitchins passed away this month, I believe on October 8th. And it just became news. We were just notified of that death this week, actually, I believe it hit the news. But
posted it on his website.
Yeah. I didn't realize he had a website, actually. But what is his website, George?
Excuse me?
Well,
it's Sitchin.com.
Sitchins.com.
www.sitchin.com.
I-N? Okay, I screwed up his spelling here on his
name. Yeah, it's a rough one there. But you spell it just the way you pronounce it. Sitchin.
Yeah. Okay, Sitchin. C-H. And I think I screwed up the Zachariah name, too, which is pretty bad. So I apologize to any Zachariah fans there, but I'll straighten that out. So what did you think, George? Remarkable man with a remarkable tenacity to keep going, you know?
Yeah. It brings back a lot of memories on my part because I was involved with his work, I think, 1975, when he came out with The 12th Planet. And it kind of set me back there for a while. I don't know why I read it. I bought it and I read it. But it wasn't. It was out of my studies at the time. But I always kept it, and never forgot him. Years afterwards, I followed astrology, and I knew more of what he was talking about. But it wasn't until years later where I actually met him, and met up with him and talked to him about some of his work.
Oh, you actually met him. That's tremendous.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. We had lunch a few times together in a few of the conferences that I attended that he attended. I think down in New Jersey years ago.
Oh.
And he was a remarkable fellow, but. You know, people would ask him, you know, about this or about that in one of his books. He goes, well, you're going to have to buy my book and find out. Which was, you know, this is the way he responded. I mean, he answered questions.
Right.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a tremendous amount of work. I mean, you got to read the, yeah, it's like everybody, you got to read the work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad you did, and I'm glad you bought the book, and I'm glad you... You introduced it. Well, actually, I learned from it from when I bought this book was when I first heard of him. But you brought him to my attention again a number of years ago, and we did a number of programs around on his work and on the Naki. We spent almost a year of shows discussing this topic. And you know,
Leo, so much of his work, but what he talks about is our history, and even from a biblical sense.
Oh, absolutely! No, I that's what I'm saying. It's absolutely phenomenal. You know what he talked about and what he brought to the forefront. You know.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think it. That's why when you suggested we do a commemorative program on him, I thought that was an excellent idea.
Mm-hmm.
In the Earth Chronicles, I don't know, you know, probably most, a lot of people who are probably listening to the show tonight or will be listening to it in the archives, I think may know about the Anunnaki and may know about Sitchin's work, but... you know, I don't know. What would you like to bring about? What do you think was his most remarkable? Contribution to the science.
Oh, there's no one thing, Leo. But his real first series of books was called the Earth Chronicles, but they made up of many many books. You know, the Ending of Days, the 12th Planet, A Stairways to Heaven, and the Wars of God and Men. You know, some of these books, they showed through the cuneiform tablets of the Sumerians, you know, the breakdown of the DNA. And it's kind of hard to even imagine. In fact, when I first read that, I didn't believe it. You know, how could this be? And, you know, I thought it was maybe some hearsay that he put together. And because some people were questioning his work over the years. And I also, as being one, but, you know, he didn't play around like that. He told the truth. And it wasn't until later years where, you know, I acknowledged his work or what he talked about. And, Leo, I think when I first met you, I talked about some of his work. And this was years after I began to study his work.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the whole thing fascinated me. This is back, God, this is, I remember talking about this back in... I bought this book. The first time I learned about it is when I bought Jim Marr's book, Ruled by Secrecy, back in 2001, I think. I think it came out in 2000. Copyright on this was 2000. I think I bought the book. I discovered it in 2001 when I bought it, and I started reading it. And since then, I've had Jim Marr's on our program I don't know, half a dozen times or more over the years, and you know, to discuss a lot of his work. But
maybe what I should do is give a little bit of background of the Anunnaki. And
I think that would be good.
And also
a little bit on I tried to give somewhat of a detailed analysis there, an intro on Zachariah himself. But
You mentioned 450,000 years ago. It was 420,000 years ago You know, you're off about 30,000 years, but this is how far back the record goes.
To refer back to our friend Jim Morris here, he says about 450,000 years ago,
right,
a group of spacefaring humanoid extraterrestrials arrived on planet Earth. And he says, then came from a planet about three times the size of Earth, which the Sumerians called Nibiru. And Nibiru depicted in the ancient Sumerian literature as the 12th planet of our solar system.
Yes.
So but it was actually, what, 430,000 years?
Well, no, it was 420,000 years, but 450, 420, you know, basically we're talking about quite a number of years. But basically this is what Zechariah Sitchin wrote, I think. That was taken, if I remember, out of the Earth Chronicles. You know, I'm going back years and years, you know, that I read this stuff. It was roughly about 420,000 years, 450,000 years, let's say. And what happened is that their planet, it made its elliptical orbit, you know, around our solar system. It took it 3,600 years to do this. So, you know, we take 1 year to go around the sun. It took 3,600 years for it to do that. So,
right.
You know, it was a very wide orbit.
Yeah, I was just kind of referring to this text again in the sense that it says, truly amazing in the fact that these ancient Sumerians, whom are told were just developing writing, accurately described and diagrammed the planets Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, even though these three worlds cannot be seen without the aid of a telescope. And Uranus was not known to modern man until discovered in 1781, Neptune in 1846, and Pluto in 1930. And long considered fanciful myths, recent interpretations of Sumerian texts, particularly one entitled Uma Elish, now known as the Creation Epic, provided the most plausible explanation for the present composition of our solar system. And why not take the epic at face value as nothing more nor less than the statement of cosmological fact as known to the Sumerians, as told to them by the Nephilim, Sitchin concluded. So they are actually phenomenal. And texts describe how more than 4 billion years ago, a rogue planet entered our solar system.
Yes.
And it narrowly missed a large planet called Tiamat.
Tiamat.
Tiamat, T-I-A-M-A-T, which cracked due to the gravitational stresses. And in a subsequent pass by Nibiru, in Sitchin's early work, he refers to this orb by the Babylonian name Marduk. Tiamat was actually struck and then bombarded by Nibiru's attendant moons.
Mm-hmm.
And various sized fragments of Tiamat remained in its orbit, in its original orbit, becoming the asteroid belt, while the other half of the planet was knocked into new orbit closer to the sun. And this fragment, over time, coalesced into Earth, and it was accompanied by one of Nibiru's moons, entitled Kingu,
yes,
which became our own satellite, which
yes,
became our
moon.
Yes. So, interestingly enough, the theory could explain why the Earth is missing much of its crust. Especially on the half encompassing the Pacific Ocean, as well as the origin of the asteroid belt. And this theory also offered an explanation for comets, which have caused so much speculation among scientists. And of course, we did two shows on the on that book by Jeffrey Goodman on the comets of the gods.
Yes.
And the idea is that when Nibiru and Tiamat collided, many tons of seawater from both worlds were thrown into space, termed mingling of the waters by the Sumerian scribes, along with the dirt and debris, which became erratic flying balls of dirt, of dirty ice. It's fascinating. I mean, it's fascinating to me what Sitchin's was able to decipher from these amazing tablets. You know?
Well, you're talking about something that happened far into their past.
Yeah, billions ago. Yeah, how could we have possibly known this stuff? You know what I mean? It was just totally an amazing discovery. And the fact being that you know, he was discredited and his works were marginalized, gives credence to the fact that the scientific community is a bunch of quacks. Okay?
Right.
And
right.
And anything that doesn't go, I mean, we talked about this along with our buddy Jeffrey Goodman.
Yes.
Who's been marginalized as well in his theories. But it's like, these are true. How could he possibly come up with this concept and be so accurate, okay, in this kind of information? And I credit a guy like Sitchin's, I tell you, for amazing, amazing, brilliant discoveries that he made. So, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, what he's put up with, I think, in the academic world, everybody... he basically didn't toe the line, and that's why there's a lot of disagreements on his work and his interpretations and so forth.
Well, God bless him, because I hope he's sitting at the right hand of God, right now, because I'll tell you, I mean, my knowledge of the academic world, because I work in it somewhat, and I've been affiliated with it for many years. To me, they're a bunch of academics are 9 out of 10 of them are idiots. They follow the line. They're just unbelievable. I mean, they're so frightened to go beyond any other the common thread. It's just amazing.
Well,
that whole academic world is, it just amazes me always. Sorry, go ahead, George.
Yeah, what you have to do, I mean, you have to see both sides of it. I mean, believe me, over the years, I've second-guessed Zechariah and what he said, and, it's only natural for me. But, I see both sides of it, I discern what is right, what I think is right, and what isn't right. It just so happens that a lot of what he said was right. You mentioned before about Tiamat and the battle. There was actually a battle between different planets and so forth. And Nibiru was part of that. And it was a moon, actually, that shattered Tiamat. But, now let's take the Nephilims and go maybe a billion years into the future. That's when basically they came and inhabited the Earth. And, Sitchin has it as 420,000 years ago, which, he talks about, they call them SARS. Every time they come around this neck of the woods, 3,600 years, is a one complete SAR. And, they talked about the at least 120 different SARS of time that they spent on this Earth even before they manipulated our race and so forth, but this was long after the original collision, and the stories that we have dealing with Enki and Enlil is a story of the two brothers who were given reign over the Earth
right.
by their father.
Right. We in fact. Lila and I, one night, read from the Book of Enki, the story of creation there.
Yes.
Quite fascinating. But
that was one of the brothers, Enki.
Right.
That was his work.
Enlil was the other, right?
Enlil, right. He was the brother, but he was the forceful one, the warrior, if you don't want
right.
to call it that.
Right.
Yeah,
and,
Enki was the doctor. The scientist,
and it was his wife, or his mate.
Yes.
And I forget mm-hmm. his name offhand, who was the donor of the egg donor, I believe,
yes.
or the
mm-hmm.
To that when they did the genetic modification of humankind, what was her name? Do you remember?
Anna.
Nana?
This is terrible.
Maybe it's in this book here, but I'll check. But I forgot who it was. But nevertheless, she was the donor, And,
Yes. There was a lot to it. I mean, it was her and also some other sisters that were involved.
Right.
And basically, it was producing a hybrid baby, and that was a from a DNA that they put together themselves.
Right. You know what amazes me, and I was so fascinated. This is when I first heard about it. Was reading this book, from Jim Mars, and it says here, life on Earth evolved based on its one-year orbit around the sun, the solar year. Life on Nibiru developed based on its one-year orbit around the sun, which is 3,600 years, okay, to Earthlings. Yeah, it then stands to reason that life on Nibiru could have evolved somewhat earlier than on Earth. And this disparity of time may also be illustrated on how an insect with a weeks-long life might perceive a human with a normal lifespan as immortal. Okay, about 450 years ago, during Earth's second ice age, the highly developed inhabitants of Nibiru and Anunnaki, the Anunnaki of the Sumerian text, journeyed to Earth as the two planets came into proximity. And according to the Sumerians, their initial landings were made in water, just as our own astronauts at first splashed down in the ocean. And logically, these ancient astronauts would have sought a base camp, which provided moderate weather and good source of water and fuel. And only one location met all these criteria, and that was in Mesopotamia. And the Indus River Valley and the Nile were two other good choices, but did not offer easy access to fossil fuel, which is still plentiful in southern Iraq. And some researchers view with suspicion the fact that the sites of these first Anunnaki settlements in the southern part of the first-day Iraq remain in the present-day Iraq remain one of the few locations in the world where first-world visitors cannot easily visit, thanks to the continued confrontation with Saddam Hussein and its attendant boycott and bombardments, and which is fascinating because, of course, this was written before the Iraq War, or actually it was after the Gulf War, but he wrote this in 2000. And with the supreme Nibirian ruler, Anu, or An or El, depending on the source, supervising their effort from the home planet, the Anunnaki began a systematic colonization of Earth under the leadership of Anu's two sons, which you stated was Enlil, Enlil, and Enki. And all of the Anunnaki leaders were later to assume the role of gods, or Nephilim, to their human subjects. Amazingly enough, one of these Nephilim was named Nazi. Believe it or not, did you know that? One must wonder if the 20th century German occultists knew of this connection. Isn't that interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Enlil was the mission commander, while Enki served as executive and science officer. And there was immediate and longstanding antagonism between the two half-brothers due to Nibirian protocol. And as in later Earth dynasties, the firstborn Enki was regulated to secondary status because his mother was not the official wife of Anu.
Right.
And this reformed him from the royal line of succession, or removed him. Yet it was Enki who led the first expedition to Earth. And one well-preserved text, Enki described his splashdown in the Persian Gulf. When I approached Earth, and this is his statement, this is Enki talking here.
Mm-hmm.
When I approached Earth, there was much flooding. When I approached its green meadows, heap and mounds, dams and dikes were piled up at my command. I built my house in a pure place. And it says Enki was both scientist and engineer, and under his leadership, the marshes on the northern shore of the Persian Gulf were drained. Dikes along the irrigation systems were built, as well as canals connecting the Tigris and the Euphrates. And reinforcements arrived under the leadership of Enki's firstborn son, Marduk. And over thousands of years, Earth time, but only a few years to the Anunnaki, a thriving colony of these visitors was put in place, and then attention turned to their primary objective, which was gold. Mm-hmm. And fascinating, the whole thing is, is fascinating because the concept, the thought, comparing an insect to us and the lifespan of an insect, you know, to an insect, of course, human beings are immortal, you know, and so the Anunnaki to us, you know, if you got to wonder about the Greek mythology, Roman mythology, and pagan mythology, you know. And the giants that were there, the great gods who played a role in mankind's fate, you know, and you know.
Well, it was also the bloodlines too, Leo.
Yeah.
The bloodlines. I mean, you had gods in those days. You had big G gods and little G gods.
Right.
And big G gods lived for thousands and thousands of years. Where the little g gods lived, you know, a couple thousand years, but their lifespans were different. Now, let's say the Old Testament. You know, Moses and some of the old prophets, you know, lived 400, 500, 700 years.
That's
so
right.
So understand, you know, there could be a number of differences that we ran across. And that could be, I think, the energies, you know, around the time span, you know, on Nibiru and with the Earth here. You have, it's like beings, our biological clocks are set up to different time cycles.
Right.
And even though the Anunnaki, if they came here, they were affected by, you know, the time sequences. And instead of living, let's say, 2,000 years, they only lived 1,800 years, but they were affected by it. And
sure.
if you pass that down to the genetic manipulating of their bloodlines, that also carried off in some of the bloodlines that go back to, like I said, some of the early prophets and so forth, where they lived a long period of time. Just like normally women gave birth at the age of, let's say, 130.
Yeah.
And, you know, and when their firstborn reaches about 80 years old, that's when they would have another one. You know, so their time span was so much different.
Oh, no, I understand. But the thing that was interesting to me is how the concept of the Anunnaki. Okay, well, once you get that idea into your mind, and then you understand the legend of the Titans. Okay, and how the mm-hmm. how the Titans and how the legends of the giants.
Yes.
Okay. Came into being, but essentially the Greek myths of the Titans, who then gave birth to, like you said, the small g gods, you know,
right.
Zeus and Apollo and all these other
mm-hmm.
Greek, but the original gods were Cronus and, you know, others who were the Titans, you know, the huge giants. So. And then the Nephilim, okay, would easily be understood to be the gods of Greek mythology and Roman mm-hmm. mythology, who intermingled with humans, okay, and often impregnated humans. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
You had these many heroes, you know.
Right.
So, you know, like Achilles and so on, you know, but. After I researched the books that I got from you, George, and more about it, I was just totally flawed, and I never could look at the world from the biblical or even the Darwinian aspect of creation made more sense to me. Okay, that we evolved. But there was always the missing link, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The missing link were these people, the Anunnaki, who genetically engineered our DNA and created, you know, the first Adamic human, you know. And
now, Leo, I ran into a problem years ago when Zechariah Sitchin talked about them genetically producing the first Adam and Eve.
Right. Right.
And for years they had problems with that. They couldn't reproduce the DNA. Just like right now we have the ability to actually make life.
Yeah. Yeah.
We can do it in the laboratories, and it's a fact. It's not a myth or whatever.
No,
but
the amazing is that science is actually caught up with, you know, with mythology. You know what I mean? So
yes.
Now we're now at the point where we can understand this from a totally different perspective than we could before. No, go ahead. I'm sorry, George. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, you know, I think what concerned me was, you know, there was a problem that they had where they actually couldn't produce this baby. And what they had to do is they had to go to an off-planet culture or civilization and manipulate some of their DNA or their bloodline. They had to get an outside source to come in and produce this on the Earth. And this is where
that source?
This was the Syrian race.
Oh, okay.
And it was the Syrian, let's say the male Syrian sperm actually given to the Anunnaki seed here from the Earth. And that was made up of, he talks about, you know, the dirt. They took dirt and made it in a test tube. But it was mixing the Earth with the Sumerian seed, and that produced the life, and that gave it the life. And that supposedly happened, Zechariah talked about, 210,000 years. And science right now, or the academic world, acknowledges that, strand of Homo sapiens came in about 208,000 years. I mean, that was the jump, or that was the biological starting of our DNA. And, you know, it's somewhat not too far off of what the Anunnaki write about, or the Sumerians write about the knowledge the Anunnaki had and the influence they had on us. And in understanding the Bible, the Adam and Eve that they talk about is basically the human race, who we are. And this was the different one from, you know, the Nephilims or the, you know, the small gods that were produced by the mating of the Anunnaki and the humans.
Right. I think it might be appropriate to read this little section here, only because it explains why they came and what actually took place. But it says, several researchers have composed elaborate metaphysical explanations for Anunnaki activities on Earth, and many having to do with energy fields and spiritual planes disrupted by the passing of Nibiru and the creation of Earth. One theory was that the higher evolved Anunnaki were attempting to rescue lost souls left behind after the planetary collision. But more documented and acceptable is the idea suggested by Sitchin and others that these colonists were after Earth's mineral wealth, particularly gold, for use on their home planet. And the Anunnaki sought gold to save their atmosphere, which had apparently sprung leaks similar to those we have created in our own, in ours, by damaging the Earth's ozone layer with hydrofluorocarbons, explained author Lloyd Pye. The Anunnaki solution was to disperse extremely tiny flakes of gold into their upper atmosphere to patch holes. And ironically, modern scientists contend that if we are ever forced to repair our own damaged ozone layer, tiny particles of gold shot into the atmosphere would be the best way to go about it. And apparently, an initial effort to retrieve gold from the Persian Gulf by the water treatment system proved inadequate for their needs. And Anu, along with his heir, Enlil, visited the colony and assigned Enki to find more gold. And Enlil was placed in overall command of the Earth colony, while Enki led to a foray to Africa and eventually to South America, where gold mining operations were set up. And proof of such early gold mining can come from scientific studies conducted by the Anglo-American Corporation, a leading South African mining corporation, in the 1970s. And company scientists discovered evidence of ancient mining operations which were dated as far back as 100,000 BC. And similar ancient mine excavations have been found in Central and South America. And this indicated the Anunnaki mining efforts were worldwide and may go far in explaining the early diffusion of humans. And further substantiation of such wide-ranging travel may be found by comparing the names of ancient Mesopotamian cities as recorded by the 2nd century AD geographer Ptolemy, who two counterparts in Central America. And it goes on to show the different Central American localities with the names of Mesopotamian localities to show how and the similarities between the pyramidal cultures of both societies, you know, or mm-hmm. both areas. So it goes on and on. It's just a totally fascinating thing. I'm glad we got to discuss that tonight, George.
Yeah, well, let me also go back for a minute. You know, when I talked before about the Homo sapiens, that was us, the Adam and Eve. There were others before him, you know, Homo erectus. You know, they go back to 300,000 years ago. I mean, there was other versions of Homo erectus or Homo sapiens, but, you know, like Neanderthal and so forth. These were all part of the genetic manipulating that went into our DNA.
No, it's true. And it even talks about it here specifically, stating that other such revisionist history, the Anunnaki had been mining gold on Earth for more than 100,000 years when the rank and file Anunnaki, who were doing the backbreaking work in the mines, mutinied about 300,000 years
ago.
And the Horn explained, elaborating on Sitchin's work. Enlil, then commander-in-chief, wanted to punish them severely, and he called an assembly of the great Anunnaki, which included his father Anu. Anu was more sympathetic to the plight of the Anunnaki miners. And he saw that the work of the mutineers was very hard, and that their distress was considerable. He wondered out loud if there wasn't another way to obtain gold. At this point, Enki suggested that a primitive worker, an Adamu, which is interesting, A-D-M-U, be created that could take over the difficult work. And Enki pointed out that a primitive humanoid, which he called Homo erectus, or a closely related humanoid, was quite prevalent in Abzu, or Africa, where he worked. And Enki's plan to create a worker race was approved by the assembly and was the starting point of humankind's origin, based on the Sumerian accounts. And this explanation also clarifies one of the most puzzling verses in the Bible. And after being assured in the Bible that there is only one true God, Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, quoted the singular God as saying, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." Mm-hmm. And this verse may carry two explanations. First, that the plural Elohim of the Old Testament, interpreted as God by the monotheists who wrote Genesis, indeed may have referred to the Anunnaki assembly, which approved the creation of man, and second, the idea of creating man in our image, meaning simply genetic manipulation of an existing species, not the creation of a new race. And as Sitchin explained, as both Orientalists and Bible scholars now know, the editing and summarizing by the compilers of the Book of Genesis was of much earlier and considerably more detailed text first written down in Sumer. And the Anunnaki's Earth mission medical officer was a female named Ninharzag, who also known as Ninti, who had already been working with Enki.
That was Enki's wife.
Mm-hmm. Right, who had already been working with Enki in genetic experimentation. And on at least one Sumerian cylinder seal, an illustration of Enki and Ninharzag depicted them surrounded by vials of vessels, a table, shelves, and a plant, and a helper, the scene looking very much like a laboratory. According to the Sumerian accounts, they produced many mutated creatures, including animals such as bulls and lions with the feet of goats. If true, it is obvious such experiments may have been the source of the many legends of mythological creatures and superhumans, such as Atlas, Goliath, Gargantua, Polyphemus, and Typhon, and not to mention the Cyclops and the thinking of the what is it, the centurion, the is it centurion, the half man, half horse.
Centurion?
Remember the one? What's that?
Centurion?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think it is the half man, half horse. Yeah. And in the 19th century, huge sphinx-like statues were excavated in what once was the place of the palace of the Assyrian king Sargon II, who ruled Mesopotamia from 721 to 705 BC. These statues included a winged bull and a lion with human heads. Much of this art was purchased by John D. Rockefeller and transported to New York. Imagine that. And the Sumerian account of the creation of the first man, written was Lu, period Lu, Lulu, in the
Lulu.
In the what's that?
Lulu.
Yeah, Lulu.
Yeah.
In the Sumerian or in the Hebrew Adama, literally translated as man of earth, or simply earthling, is quite clear in light of today's knowledge concerning cloning. But up to within 25 years ago or so, the whole concept would have been incomprehensible to even the most learned scholar. And Enki and Ninhursag took the reproductive cell or egg from a primitive African female hominoid and fertilized it with the sperm of young Anunnaki male. And the fertilized ovum was then placed inside an Anunnaki woman, reportedly Enki's own wife, Ninki, okay, who carried the child to term. And although the cesarean section was required at birth, a healthy young male Adama hybrid was produced for the first time on Earth, bypassing natural evolution by millions of years. And according to the ancient Sumerian reporters, when mankind was first created, they knew not the eating of bread, knew not the dressing with garments, ate plants with their mouth like sheep, and drank water from the ditch. Okay, afterwards, Enki and Narsag went on to produce a number of Adamas, both male and female, although at this time they were incapable of reproduction and lived very short lives compared to the Anunnaki. This was apparently done in a conscious effort to prevent any competition from the new human race. It is interesting to note that according to Genesis 3, chapter 3, verse 5, the very first order of the Elohim was that man, in the allegorical form of Adam and Eve, was to remain ignorant, lest ye shall be as gods. That's interesting, ain't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, remember, you can't eat of the fruit of the tree, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, or you'll be as, you can't, yeah, don't, you can't have this knowledge. So several connections between the Sumerian version of man's creation and the Bible are apparent.
Right.
And the Bible speaks of women being created from Adam's rib, and the great Sumerologist Samuel L. N. Kramer pointed out near the middle of this century that the tale of Eve's origin from Adam's rib probably stemmed from the double meaning of the Sumerian word ti or tai, which means both rib and life, explained Horm. So Eve may have received her life from Adam without any bone being involved, or genetic material may have been extracted from bone marrow.
Hmm.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think it was actually biological cells removed from bone marrow. But, you know,
yeah,
since
Adam was the first test tube baby, proclaimed Sitchin, after the birth of the first modern test baby in 1978. Hmm. And he saw this modern birth as support for his Sumerian translations, especially in light of the fact that modern science only began to conceptualize manipulating our genetic makeup within the 20th century.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So Sitchin's was so far ahead of his time with this concept, you know, coming from the Sumerian tablets.
In taking this up to most recent history, and yeah. I am to the last cataclysm that goes back 9772 BC. That basically was when Atlantis went under, and understand that man, this Homo, or this Adam seed that you're talking about, actually evolved into beings with knowledge that matched the Anunnaki.
Yeah. Yeah, it says the ancient aliens passed along symbols representing the long-forgotten science of cloning. It is suggested by the Caduceus, the logo of physicians even today. And this ancient symbol of living, life-giving medical treatment represented by entwined snakes. Okay, the symbol of the entwined snakes along a winged staff bears a striking resemblance to the double spiral strings of the DNA molecules. And DNA, only discovered in 1946, is composed of the amino acids within the human cell that store the individual genetic blueprint. It is the manipulation of DNA which can produce a clone, a duplicate, or a hybrid. And let's say evidence that the first primitive humans originated in Africa has grown since the 1970s, when some of the oldest pre-human remains were found there. The bones of Lucy, the other Australopithecines, clearly indicated the early primates lived in the area of Earth where more than 3 million years ago, but were not as evolved as even the Neanderthal. And contrary to popular belief, scholars C.P. Grow, Charles E. Louis Leakey have agreed that Australopithecus was totally different in morphology from humans. And Groves commented that non-Darwinian principles would be required to explain any connection between Lucy and modern humans. But woe to those who attempt to argue against conventional thinking. You see there? Okay, because, and this is what we were talking about earlier. According to many independent researchers, there appears to be a conspiracy against any discovery which conflicts with prevailing wisdom. And one example was the fate of Tom E. Lee of the National Museum of Canada, who in the early 1950s discovered advanced stone tools and ice on the Manitoulin Island in Lake Huron. These tools were shown to be at least 65,000 years old, and perhaps as old as 125,000 years, and totally contradicting conventional theories. Lee claims he was hounded from his position as his work was misrepresented and no one would publish his findings, and most of the artifacts vanished into storage bins, and the museum director was fired for refusing to discharge Lee. The treatment of Lee was not an isolated case, noted the authors of Forbidden Archaeology. There exists in the scientific community a knowledge filter that screens out unwelcome evidence, and this process of knowledge filtration has been going on for well over a century and continues right up to the present day. And one particularly exasperated researcher recently wrote, "Realize that scientific institutions such as the Smithsonian and the National Geographic Society are set up by the world's elite factions in the first place to either debunk, distort, or simply ignore any scientific data that tends to enlighten people about their true origins." Bang! Right there. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's why to me, probably the most frustrating thing I've ever faced was the stupidity of academics, okay, in so many areas. I mean, they're just trained to teach the standard, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever is acceptable, you know, and not go beyond that. It's really frightening to me. And, you know, that's why I'm grateful we get a chance to talk about this tonight, George.
Well, you know, Zechariah, he concentrated, I think, on the Anunnaki. But there are other civilizations out there in the cosmos that, had some kind of part in our history. And like I said before, the Syrians were also another part of the Adam seed. And understand that Sirius is our twin star in the Milky Way here. So, we have direct connections with Sirius. But
right.
I want to go back to what I was saying before. 9772 was the last cataclysm that we had, which wiped out Atlantis. But it also, what went down with Atlantis was, I think, the recognition and the accomplishments that the Adam had. And we were the ones that built that pyramid. It wasn't an outside source. It was we, Homo sapiens, you know, from the Earth. And the one thing that the Anunnaki realized, and I think I picked this up from Zechariah one time, that the Anunnaki accepted us as being equal to them because they wanted to control us, but they couldn't control us and our soul. And this was by a higher order that also controlled their soul, which controlled our soul. So we were equal to, let's say, the power of the consciousness that the Anunnaki have and that we have also. And, you know, that's one thing that they that we are equal about, and the Anunnaki acknowledged. And I think what's happening is in the precession of the equinox, 12,000 years ago is when this catastrophe took place. And right now, we have come full circle, and we are just remembering what we achieved at that time and what we do have. And part of that is part of the evidence that, you know, Zechariah Sitchin refers to as you know, civilizations of antiquity. And it connects with the Earthlings ourselves. And, you know, I'm also connecting with the Egyptians and the Atlanteans that has been here for 800,000-900,000 years. You know, there is Homo erectus, if you want to call us by a name, Homo sapiens. We're bipod beings, and part of this is connected with the three-dimensional physical makeup of our reality. And, I mean, it falls within the confines of science and of creation as we know it, just like the Phi principle, the spiraling of a seashell. That is part of our makeup, and any beings that walk the planet would have to have characteristics, you know, that would fall within the confines of the physical environment.
I think the fascinating thing here that stated that since the first human workers were like mules and could not procreate, the Anunnaki had to constantly create new batches, a time-consuming procedure considering the span of time between in vitro fertilization and birth. So Enki and Ninharsag, who was his lab tech, set about to create an Adama race which could reproduce itself. Now, Genesis 2, chapter 2, verse 8 to 15, makes it clear that the Adama was created elsewhere and then placed in the Garden of Eden, or that area of the original Anunnaki colony called Edin, which is E-D-I-N, which is really fascinating, isn't it? Okay, and accurately described as the plain between Tigris and the Euphrates River, which is where the original Eden is considered to be, remember?
Yes. Yeah.
And accurately described as the plain between Tigris and Euphrates. The Sumerian text relates how an envious Enlil, forcibly took humans from Enki's African lab and returned with them to Eden, and where they were put to work producing food and serving the Anunnaki. But Enlil needed even more workers and turned to his brother Enki for help. And Alfred theorized that the retaliation for Enlil's raid on his African lab, Enki traveled to Eden, where he created a human reproduction lab for Enlil, but secretly manipulated the genetic code to allow sexual reproduction. And it's just fascinating.
Leo, I would recommend to our audience out there, you know, I'm no expert with Zechariah Sitchin. That's for, you know, I'm the first to admit that. But
right.
I think his materials is mind-boggling. And, the legends are so fascinating.
The way he links it up and everything, it's just remarkable. And it's given me so much more insight in studying his work to understanding the human condition.
Uh-huh.
Makes so much more sense now. And I have to recommend, that people read the Earth Chronicles. And also, if they that this great introduction to his work by Jim Morris. Mm-hmm. It's in the latter part of his book. But he has a whole section called the Anunnaki and the Rule by Secrecy. And I highly recommend that book, and any work by Jim Morris is quite good. But definitely Zachariah Sitchin, Sitchin is worth a read, and to better understand the human condition, I think. You know, what do you think, George?
Without a doubt. But you know, there's so much of his research has to do with his love, and that is the Bible. And, you know, it's correlating a lot of the Sumerian texts with what is written in the Bible. And he's done quite a bit to prove, you know, of some of the knowledge that the ancients had. And he's the first one to connect those ancients, you know, with all planet extraterrestrials.
Oh, wow. No, I believe it or not, our show is kind of stopped streaming right now.
Okay.
But it's been a fascinating show, George. And, you know, anything with Sitchin's is always good. But
well, I wasn't expecting to talk about it so soon. I just learned about his death yesterday. But what I would like to do is maybe spend some more time and reviewing and putting a show together, and we could talk about some of his accomplishments and maybe bring out some of his materials and talk about it.
I think it's good because essentially we're talking about the possible return of Nibiru.
That's right. Yes. Mm-hmm.
As the blue planet, in 2012 or 2011, somewhere in the very near future. So I think it's a great topic to consider talking. And I just wanted to say, we're for the family of Mr. Sitchin and all of his many readers and followers. We like to express our sympathy for his loss, and we
thank him. I celebrate, his materials, and I celebrate him. God bless him, and I'm glad that he's on his path, and he's going to a new life. And hell, he's done his work here.
Absolutely, it definitely gave us many things to consider, and a truly remarkable genius. And we highly commemorate him here tonight, and. Thank you, George, for bringing that up. And
I want to thank you for bringing me on your Thursday night show, my friend. It's been a pleasure being with you, and we'll have to do it again another time.
Yeah, we will, and we definitely will. And I think that we'll leave it at that. But we won't be having the show tomorrow night. So, but I wanted to thank you for being on tonight, and I think that. I think people got quite an earful tonight, and hopefully they'll research some of Zachariah Sitchin's work.
There you go.
Okay, George. Well, thanks for being with us. Have
a
good week. All right, and I'll talk to you very soon.
God be with you, my friend. Thank you.
Good night.